First, everyone, welcome. Welcome. This is a series of six classes and a day long. So I'd like you to also mark down the day long, February 20th, which will be a Saturday, and it will go from 9 to 4:30, and is a kind of a culmination of what we will have learned here in the subsequent 6 weeks. So it's an important component to this series that you come to that day long. And that'll be at our Dharma Center, and I'll have directions for you later in the course. But this is a series of six classes in which we'll be exploring the theme of mindfulness, awareness, and it can be called mindfulness meditation. It's also called Vipassana meditation, V-I-P-A-S-S-A-N-A, or sometimes insight meditation. Any of those are interchangeable words. Most of you probably recognize the word mindfulness. And this is a little different than the way it's normally taught in the West, mindfulness, in the sense that if you have a particular difficulty like stress or depression or something, you have a mindfulness, you tone or focus your mindfulness in on that particular difficulty, and then you look at the thoughts you're attributing to that particular problem or whatever it might be. And it's a very kind of selective, focused way of working with awareness. In this tradition, we look at the mind. We begin to understand the nature and how the mind works. Then at the end of 6 weeks and a day long, likely you'll be able to have a different orientation to how to work with different problems as they arise, rather than those specific difficulties that you might have learned your mindfulness approach from. Once you know how the mind, the landscape of the mind, and how to work with thoughts and emotions and the continuous commentary that's going on in all of us, as you begin to understand what those particular mental dispositions are and how to decrease fear in relationship to them, you have a different way of understanding your particular difficulties as they arise individually. So hopefully it will cover pretty much the spectrum of problems that you might have, and you may save yourself a little money from having to go to a mindfulness class in addition to this. So let me just tell you a little bit about myself, because whenever you're working with the mind, you need to have somebody who is skilled in being able to do that. And so I sit here in front of you with 40 years of meditation practice. Ellen, my wife here, has well over three decades of meditation practice. And we don't just decide we hang up our shingle and start teaching meditation. One's teacher selects you to teach, so it's a lineage. And so according to that particular way of thinking, my teacher said at some point he thought that I should start teaching meditation, and his teacher did the same, and his teacher all the way back to the time of the Buddha. So that's the lineage. The concept of lineage is very strong in this particular tradition. And the West has picked up a part of that with, as I mentioned, the mindfulness movement. But it doesn't necessarily require them to have much background when they start teaching that, which is unfortunate because they're working with minds. And you better know the landscape of the mind if you're going to be working. So you can sit back with some degree of relaxation, knowing that Ellen and I are very aware of the difficulties that arise in the course of meditation, and will be very, make suggestions and corrections when we see that you're doing something wrong. So, as I mentioned, this would be six classes. I would really suggest that none of you miss a class. If you have to miss a class, you can make it up. We have a video set of these series on video on our website, seattleinsight.org. You can go to that website and whatever class you miss, you can select that video to watch, and it also has the homework, etc., for that particular evening. You can also do that if you come to the class, because the discourses that I give, the talks I give in the course of the evening, and often the instructions may vary from one series to another. So you might listen to the series that has been recorded previous to this and pick up some new pointers or things I didn't talk about in this series. Again, seattleinsight.org, please help yourself. You'll find lots of resources up there as well as those videos. So feel fine to do that. If you have to miss two classes, that's really too many in a series of six, and I would suggest that instead of trying to piece together what this series is about with four classes, that you just start a series when you can do all six. So missing one, you can make up with the video. Missing two is probably too many, and encourage you to move to another series rather than to try to piece this one together. This insight meditation comes from a Buddhist tradition. The images behind me are not ours. We're renting this facility. And so don't let that become too prominent in your mind, those images that look sometimes terrifying and golden and huge have their own representation within the Tibetan tradition, which is a different lineage than the one we're teaching from. But it does come from the Buddhist tradition, but we're not here to try to make you a Buddhist. In fact, you'd be better off if you didn't become a Buddhist or anything else. The point of all of this is to kind of see what's there when we release the beliefs that we have lived with for so long, and all the opinions that we have hold, and all of the ways that we react and react to so many situations. If we just kind of have a clearinghouse here, where we just release our need to have to believe anything, because this tradition isn't really about belief, it's about seeing, it's about direct observation. When you see something, as opposed to hear it and think, oh, that makes sense, I think I'll believe that, there's a whole different way that that enters the body and transforms the tissues of the body in terms of an integrated whole. If you think of anything that you know for certain, that you've seen, that can't be taken from you. You don't have to argue it. And it's that sense of certainty and confidence that the practice gives you when you've actually looked and seen what was there, as opposed to what someone told you was there, that is at the hallmark of how insight meditation changes you. So we're not asking you to believe anything. The Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. He was just somebody who was talking about what he saw from his own experience. Right? So in that sense, you won't become proselytized. You're just no converts here. I do like to find out what you're showing up with, what your expectations are for this evening. And if you don't mind, just if you have an expectation that you're coming with, just raise your hand and let me know, and I'll speak to whether this practice addresses that or not. So anyone, what do you want from the meditation? What would you like to have it do for you? Yes.
Control stress.
Say again.
Control stress.
Control stress. Yeah, that's a very important one. It's probably the leading reason that people choose mindfulness meditation. And it's one that we live with, because we live sort of victims to our inward pressures that we put on ourselves. Time, all about time, getting things done, being accomplished, productive, useful. We wake up in the morning with a kind of internal clock that pushes us to extremes. And this particular stress is not only due to our own internal speed and how we push ourselves forward, but also to our huge idealism and personal expectation of doing something wrong, whether we are being accepted for what we do, and all of that is an additional pressure. So we're going to look at that. We're going to look at that's part of the way the mind is manifested, manifests in a culture where we are sort of being driven by a market economy. And I'm not, this is not a political series, believe me. Oh, we need to know what are the conditioning forces that are working, and certainly the economics of the world, of our culture, put a certain pressure on us. And so we have to be aware, you know, of what those pressures are and how they're pushing us forward at the expense of a greater sense of contentment that we, that's available to us, but it's not available to us in the way that we have consented our lives to be governed by the culture. So we'll be looking at that. We'll be talking about that. Thank you. One of you, yes.
So to identify my personal biases and to become more generous.
To become more generous, a heart longing. I appreciate that, because what you find is that the energies that we live with are very cognitive energies. They're mostly intellectual or conceptual energies. They're logic, and they're have a lot to do with what we say to ourselves up here in our brains. All that is a conditioned reflex. But an underserved organ for most of us is our heart. We haven't nurtured it because of the pressures that we put ourselves under. We focus in on this organ rather than the organ that is in the center of our chest. And once we can relax a little bit about what is going on up here and not be driven by it and not be a puppet to it, the energies naturally resettle themselves, readjust themselves. And you find yourself available or noticing the problems of the world from a different vantage point. And you get in touch with life in a more sensitive way. And when that happens, the heart opens. There's a natural response of the heart to pain is compassion. It's just that most of us don't want anything to do with pain, so we stay very distant from it. We don't allow ourselves to actually feel the pain that's in front of us. And so compassion never has the ability to respond unless we feel the pain. So if we avoid pain, then we're not going to feel compassion. And when we begin to settle with what it means to be present to pain and be able to open to it in a way that perhaps we haven't in our past, you'll find a natural intrinsic quality in each of us that allows us to come comfortably into our hearts. The expression of our heart in one aspect is compassion, as I just mentioned, but in a different line, when you're feeling or seeing people who are disadvantaged, the expression of that is generosity, is abundance. It's when we feel so sparse and scarce in ourselves that we don't have enough, that the generosity doesn't have a free-floating way to move out. And most of us are so self-protected and so armored in thinking of ourselves as insufficient and not having enough, that this natural quality of generosity never becomes available to us. So that's something that I think, especially if you intend it, and let me just say a little bit, it really does, if this practice is going to work, it does require your intention. And it requires your attention, but more importantly than even that is your intention. So here's someone who's spoken about generosity, who actually has the intention to change herself to someone who's more that sees from abundance rather than scarcity. So that will be there for you if you so wish it. Yes, sir.
Maybe it's related, but I'd like to find a way to still my mind.
Still your mind. Well, that's the usually the that's the one that most of us come to meditation for. Is that if you have any inward experience, and if you haven't, you will by the end of the night. You'll know what he means by it. What does he mean, still mind? Well, you'll know that this thing isn't quiet up here. It jabbers all the time. And you can't turn it off. There's no off switch to it. So what are you going to do? There's no off switch. And when you sit down, you'd like nothing more than to have some respite from all that noise. And yet the noise, it's like a radio. Except the radio isn't some distant corner. It's right in your ear. And it just jabbers. So what does this meditation have to do with that? Well, it has a lot to do with that. In fact, I would say that the central effect of meditation is that it allows us to have some space, inward space, to the noise of our mind. And it's the fact that we keep encouraging and reacting in a very in very damaging ways that keeps this noise so abundantly loud. And it's, when we learn how to rest with our inward processes with some degree of contentment, say, okay, so I'm feeling this emotion, no big deal. Let's just relax with it a little bit. The whole sound apparatus or the whole sound system starts quieting down along with it. And you can see things that you haven't seen before because you're not being governed by the noise. It's a very interesting process. I will be speaking a lot about that. Yes?
The practice letting go of assigning labels or judgment to experiences based on the past.
The experience of constant judging and labeling regrets and lack of forgiveness and all of that sort of. We have a backlog of all of that in our system, don't we? So, how does this practice work with all of that? That constant, again, it's really this noise and emotions that we have locked ourselves into over time. And I think what you'll find is none of this is an overnight. I mean, this is really not a McDonald's approach to living. If this gets into you sufficiently, which is what I hope you get out of 6 weeks and a day long, is that it just buries itself enough so that you can't live without it. If it does that, I've been successful. Right? And then for the rest of your life, you will learn how to manage your inward mind, and to keep it from driving you insane. And there will be many, many opportunities to engage the meditation, because insanity is really much more common than we might believe. In fact, sanity is much rarer than you would ever think. So how is it, you know, is it like, what's going on in here? What is all this? What's the world that I see? What's the sense of me that I have believed so strongly in all this? What is that? What is all of that? It opens up a kind of wonder. You start walking into this enormously complex conditioning. And it's awe-inspiring. I think it's the most interesting thing you'll ever do. Without a doubt. I mean, why would I do it for 40 years, right? Because it's fascinating. And it gets more fascinating the deeper you go. So I think you're going to find, if you really work, and I'm going to give you a lot of homework. I'm not an easy I'm not a laid back, I will work you. I really do need you to step up into the practice if you're to carry this out of here after these 6 weeks. You've got some real work to do to get it in there, to start adjusting, and we will give you those assignments that will allow that to happen. Yes?
I have a very strong inner critic that drives self-limiting behavior, so I would like to quiet that inner critic.
Quiet the inner critic.
Yeah.
Critic. You see, when you want to look at the product of what you live with as a conditioning product, this is the result of how you grew up, and you can probably very quickly see why there's a critic there at all when you have lived with the situations and circumstances that you did, plus a school system that evaluates and judges and all of that. You see why we're so full of judgment and so full of evaluation. And so when you begin to sense that, you see that what has been conditioned in you over time can be extinguished. It's not a given. You don't have to live with this the rest of your life. You just have to find a way that doesn't recondition the same expressions that you're trying to get out of into you as you're trying to get out of them. And because that's what we usually do, is we start looking at our minds to begin with and judging what we see, thinking that's the way out of judgment. But it's not, of course, to self-condemn or to judge ourselves with how well we're doing as we are looking at our mind just really invites more gasoline on the fire. Right? So we're going to be very cautious and very very patient with how it is that we bring our attention to the mind, because equally as important as the attention that we give the mind is what we're thinking in response to what we're seeing. So those two things go hand in hand. And so we'll bring that up as the course unfolds. Okay, so welcome. Welcome. This is my last scheduled series of beginning series. I've done over the years probably 100 of these series, and I'm in my final year of teaching here in Seattle, where next year I will take a year off and retire for at least that year. And so this is a kind of special group to me, because you represent sort of my parting class. I hope that you find it as valuable as I have over the years. You certainly can. It can be as an amazing and very important practice if you allow it to. But we're going to show you how to meditate, because that's why we're here. And so we're going to go on the stage here for a second and bring some apparatus with us and show you how to sit. Now, most of you probably think of meditation as what these gentlemen are doing up here on the stage, sitting cross-legged and with their back erect and off, looking very contented and otherworldly. We want this to be easy for you. We don't want it to be hard. And I don't even know if they had chairs back there 2,500 years ago, but we do. So you're welcome to learn to meditate sitting on a chair or on the ground, if that's your particular choice. But I'm going to show you both ways. So we're going to start off with a chair. And because she's a little shorter than the chair, she needs to put something comfortable in between her the feet or feet in the floor, just to add that extra few inches for support. She's sitting with a pillow behind her, but her back is not going to rest on the pillow. What happens is that you need to swing forward a little bit so that your back isn't resting against the back of the chair. And the pillow allows you to have enough support in your lower back so that you can swing out. So her back is straight. In fact, if I had a string that went right through her vertebrae off the top of her head and I pulled the string, the way she would line up would be how I what would happen if I pulled that string. Her hands are folded in her lap, but they can be on her knees. Whatever is comfortable, there's no one way for someone to have their hands. And she could stay like this for an hour or more, very easily. So that's the sitting posture. Again, an important part of that is to make sure that your legs are comfortably settled so that your feet aren't dangling. See, if she took this pillow off, she would just be on her tiptoes, and that's not a comfortable way to stay for very long. So, okay. Now, I'll show you the floor position. Now, these floor cushions are called zavitas. That's the square one that you rest your knees and legs upon. It keeps the ankles from touching the bare, hard floor. And this is called a zafu. They're usually round like this, but she brought one that's more trapezoidal. So sometimes we can use a support cushion. I'm going to show you the support cushion. Now, the point of the support cushion is to bow the back so that it shifts and tilts the back forward so that there's a natural bow here. Without that, I'm going to pull it out here. Without that, it's a little harder. It's not quite as much angle for the bow to occur. So my suggestion is, if you're on the floor, is to try it with a support cushion, and that can help settle into the position. Now, her legs naturally go to the floor because she's been doing this for so long, but most people's legs early on don't meet the floor. And if they don't, and you'd like to sit on the floor, then you can use various cushions between your leg and the zabutan, so that there's enough support there, so there isn't too much pain as the leg settles down onto the floor. She's turning now to a straddle position. So you can take your cushion and you can straddle your legs back. Many people find this more comfortable to straddle like that. Again, your back is bowed, which is important. The shoulders are squared. This is true for all the positions. It's not really easier to sit on the floor than it is the chair because it requires the same kind of dynamics of squaring the shoulders and straightening the back. But different people are more comfortable in the different positions. And the West, we've invented a meditation bench, which is naturally angled to keep that bow going. You can see, I hope, that this has been cut to an angle. When you set it down, it slopes towards her. And so then she can very comfortably sit on that bench with her legs between the legs of the bench. And this provides stability and rest so that she can meditate as she wishes. Okay? All right. That looks good. So, any questions about sitting meditation? pretty clear. Yes, sir.
If I'm sitting in the chair here,
yeah,
I should not be leaning back against.
That's right. When you're sitting in a chair, first of all, your legs are parallel to one another, your feet are parallel to one another, flat on the floor, not crossed like this, straight on the floor. And your back, which is resting on the chair now, swings forward like that. So that you can feel your buttocks in the back of the chair meet at that place. But the back of the chair, you shouldn't feel the rest of your back. So you're moving this way. And that just keeps you. So that's why it's very helpful if you take a little pillow and put it down by where the seat and your buttocks meet. That just gives you a slight enough angle to push you forward a little bit, like that. Okay. All right, so now we're going to meditate. What did you think we were doing? Say again.
Eyes open and close.
Thank you. For most people, we ask you to keep your eyes closed. All right. Some people aren't comfortable in that position, and so if you then decide that a more comfortable position for you is to keep your eyes open, what I would suggest doing is keeping your head very still, opening your eyes just about halfway, looking down about 5 or 6 feet in front of you, and staring at a particular point on the floor. And then just holding your gaze there without looking around, because when you're looking around, you're really encouraging a lot of thought in that wavering attention. Rather than doing that, just settle your attention down in front of you and focus in and keep your attention steady. And that's also a good way. In fact, some traditions like Zen meditation and even some Tibetan traditions have you open your eyes. In this tradition, because we're encouraging an inward experience, then we usually suggest keeping your eyes closed. So, but here's another reason. If you happen to be sleeping, which you will, if you've ever tried to meditate for very long, you know that sleepiness is not far away. In that moment when you're about ready to fall asleep, it's nice to sort of settle yourself down, open your eyes, and finish your meditation with your eyes open. And that often provides just enough stimulation because of the light that'll keep you awake. So I'll have a lot more to say about that. Here, we're just going to sit for 5 minutes. Don't want to wear you out. So sit comfortably with your shoulders squared and your back, if you're on a chair, swinging forward from the back of the chair. If you're on the floor, having sufficient leverage so that if your hips are bowed or your back, your lower back is bowed, and that you feel comfortable, that you can. If you have 1 foot under the leg, you're going to find that your legs are going to go to sleep. It's probably better to have your legs. Ellen, you want to show them how your legs are there?
Oh. Yeah.
They're side by side, or like that, rather than on top of each other. And you'll find that to be much more comfortable, though initially it may not feel that way. Okay, so the first thing you do when you meditate is that you release the day. You don't think about the day. It's not about conjuring up the day and thinking about, you know, what Bill said to me at lunch. It's really to clear all this out. All right, so just let yourself release yourself from the day. And you can feel very quickly that it gets quieter just in not compelling the day forward. Now settle into your body. Call your attention into your body so that you know you're sitting, so that there's a feeling of physical presence within your awareness. You know that you're sitting. This is, meditation is a very in-the-body experience. We want you to know where you are at all times. Right? You're drifting off somewhere. That's thinking. That's not being present. Being present, when you're present, you know that you're present. And so mindfulness can be defined as being present. And then there's the knowing of where you're located, of what you're focused on, of what you're attending to. Now, most people, when they start paying attention, find how quickly they lose any connection to what they're paying attention to, because they think their way out of it. They're thinking about other thoughts and they just go off somewhere. So we're going to suggest that you focus in on your breathing to begin with. And the breath is beautiful, because if you're anywhere else, you know you've slipped off. And the point is to keep coming back to the breath. So for the moment we are talking here, just get a sense of the physical sensation, because the body moves when you breathe in. It moves. The belly moves out, the chest expands, the air passes over the nose tip. Just feel the different sensations when you take a breath in, and then the reverse of those sensations as you let the breath out. So you're not trying to control the breath, you're just noticing the physical sensations that accompany the breath. And you're allowing yourself to relax here. This is key. Equal to paying attention is the willingness to release all the tension that we've accumulated in the day. So you just want to embody a sense of relaxation and ease. While the body's straight, attention is crisp, inwardly it feels tranquil. There's nothing, you're not forcing yourself, you're just bringing your attention to the breath. Breath in, breath out, breath in, then you slip away. And you're thinking for a long period of time. That's okay. Whenever you notice you've slipped away, just bring your attention back. That's all. But before you bring your attention back, first connect with a sense of deep physical relaxation, so that you bring your attention back through relaxation. Deeply relaxed. And the breath will be much more obvious to you when you're relaxed than if you try to find it when you're not. So I'm going to be quiet now for 5 minutes, and we're just going to stir yourself back awake too harshly. Just let your attention softly open. And look around from soft eyes, allowing your eyes to be soft. So you're not trying to come back to your normal attention and consciousness. You're allowing them to be soft and just remain at that level of subtlety that the meditation induced. So I don't really have to ask whether people were able to follow their breath, because I know none of you were. And the reason I know that is because I've been teaching for 30 years, and that's the way that people start, is that they can be with one or two breaths and then they're off for a long period of time. This is how all people begin practice, okay? So don't expect anything other than that from your practice. You have to be very patient with this. If you're patient, that's number one. And we're not a very patient culture. We'd like to get this thing done, get it under our belt, and move on. But this is just you just can't do it that way. And so it's going to already start engendering some very important qualities into your temperament, and patience is one of them. You're going to find out, well, I'm not a patient person. Well, you're not going to last very long in meditation. Because, and if you do, you will become patient. So if that's something that stirs you, that you'd like to be, well, the practice demands it. And it's because if you looked at the graph of number of breaths over time, number of breaths increasing over time, the graph does go up. It is a positive slope, but it goes up not in a straight linear positive direction without, it goes up in pits and valleys. It goes like this. And so many of the times you're sitting, you feel like you're less able to do what you were doing before in previous sittings. And you just, that's just the way, that's the disposition of meditation. But over time, if you persist, the ability to attend, to pay attention, to attend, will begin to increase. And so that you'll be able to just to place your attention where you would like it to be without it running off constantly. Now that's just one of the positive benefits of the meditation. That's just one. But it's significant, because what do you do that wouldn't be benefited by your paying attention? So it's helpful already. Now, the other thing that you need to become aware of is that you are already learning about the mind. What did you learn about the mind? You learned that it doesn't stop talking. Some of you who have never sat before may not have learned that prior to these 5 minutes. You learn that you can't shut it off. Why? I didn't ask you to talk to yourself. I asked you to follow your breath. And yet you couldn't stop. The chatter doesn't stop. Why? Why? That's actually a very deep question. Why is that so? Why can't I say, okay, shut up. 5 minutes later, I'm saying, okay, now you can talk again. Because much of the thoughts that we have, many of the thoughts that we have, much of the thinking we have, are just neurons firing. That's what the dream state is. It's a continuation of the noise we live with. And we have never tried to shut it off. We've never learned, we just accept that fact in ourselves. And we haven't learned how to live with it. We live at its command. Its command central. Whatever the voice in the head tells us to do, we do. And yet, a lot of it is just nonsense. All of it is conditioned, and mostly it's conditioned nonsense. It just puts in different neurological pathways and comes out with this thought. You go, okay. Suddenly you're feeling things about yourself that aren't based upon any reality. And so you begin to see that the thoughts we live with are disjointed. They have no context to the reality that's actually occurring. Mostly they have context to our behavioral background, to our history, to what we believe about ourselves. Now we see somebody acting, grimacing, we think, oh, I never did like myself, and now that's proof he doesn't like me either. And he may just have eaten something sour or something. I don't know. But you begin to understand, or can you begin to develop a clearer idea of what reality really is, as opposed to what our mind is saying is occurring. That is the beginning of sanity. Okay, so now if we just did this for 5 minutes a day, and the other 23 hours and 55 minutes we just let our mind do whatever it's doing, it wouldn't be very effective. We have to be able to bring this thing into movement so that we can actually meditate while we're moving in action. Right? So we have this, now we're at a bus stop, I know what I can do. I can sit and follow my breath, that's great. Or taking 10 minutes out of my lunch break. Right? But that's not sufficient because most of the time I'm in movement. That's walking meditation, and I'm going to teach that to you now. First, let me just explain what walking meditation is. And when we're in movement, we really don't care about the movement. We don't care about what's happening at the moment we're moving. We care about where the movement is going to take us, the product, the goal. If I'm reaching for a glass of water, all this is wasted time. This is what I want, right? That's what the reaching's all about. And so we'll find that we'll only show up for ourselves at those moments in which the goal is acclaimed. So the water or the food or whatever it is that we're trying to address. So if that's the case, which believe me it is for most of us, that's about 99% of your life that you're missing. While you're waiting around for the one thing that you want to pay attention to, the rest of it is passing you by. Okay, we want to reclaim that. Okay, so I've spent years and years in hospice care as a caregiver and as a clinician, but also as an administrator. And I can tell you that there can be a deep sadness in people who have lived their lives and missed most of it. There's no way to reclaim it when you only have a month or two to live. But for many of us here in the room, we have longer than that, and we can reclaim much of our life if we learn how to pay attention through all of the different movements that we normally just bypass. And that's the point of walking meditation. The point of walking meditation is to teach us that there is no incidental movement, that all movement is relevant because we're living it. And it teaches us how to live each move. So it's a very formal way of moving stylistically, because normally we don't walk this slowly or with this procedure. But we have an area about 10 feet apart, so there could be two people walking, one walking from here to the end of that stage, and one person walking from here to the other end of the stage. And that's about the length you need, even 5 or 10 feet, that's all. And you pay attention to what the body is doing as it's moving. So instead of just saying, okay, I want to get to the end of the stage and forgetting about everything, you're actually noticing what it is that's happening as you are moving towards the end of the stage. And this is when I would like to ask you to stand up, because I want in practice to show you that it's possible to pay attention to what the body's doing. Now, move aside from others or from things that you might be stepping on so that you can take a step without fear of falling or stepping on someone. And for this procedure only, not for walking in general, we keep our eyes open. But I just want you to hold it, the inward sense of what it feels like in the body. So I would ask you to close your eyes, but just make sure you can take a step without faltering. All right, so just close your eyes. Now move your attention into your body. So you're feeling the body. And just begin to see how you stand, how you stand. Does your stand have an attitude with it? Does it have a discouragement? Does it have a betrayal or a sense of a lack of confidence or doubt? You see, how do we hold ourselves? And then just scan the body. Just let your attention flip through the body and see where your judgments lie in terms of body. You know, where is it that this is not, doesn't fit the magazine cover? And that's intrinsic. We get up out of bed with that kind of judgment. When we begin to notice that it's occurring, we then can do something about it. But if we just think it's the state of affairs, it gets reinforced moment after moment from our lack of attention. So now let your attention settle down all the way through the body to where the feet rest on the floor. Feel the quality of contact of your feet to the floor. Now think of two or three words that describe the nature of that contact, like soft or hard, or warm or cool, or rough or smooth. So if you were telling somebody about the nature of the contact of your feet to the floor, let those words come to mind. Now this is a key point. Notice the difference between, take one of those words like soft. Notice what the experience of that is, and how when you call it a word like soft, and you're saying it to someone or writing it in a letter or an email, it has there's a disassociation between that and the experience. It's no longer held within the experience of softness. It's a memory of what softness used to be. You see? So anytime we are talking or speaking or describing, we're no longer in contact to the real experience of life. It's an abstraction. Why is that important? Well, we'll see why that's important. But for now, I just want you to know that it's important. Okay, so now as you're standing there, shift your weight from the right side of your body to the left side and just feel what that feels like as the right side becomes lighter and the left side becomes heavier. Now lift the right foot and just place it a couple of inches ahead of the left, taking a step and feeling that placement, and then the shifting of the weight from the left side back to the right as the left heel begins to rise, and then the left toe comes alongside the right toe, and then the redistribution of weight between the two feet. Okay, so now go back, open your eyes, go back to where you were standing, and take a step on your own, noticing as much of the different facets of that step as possible. So just on your own, go ahead and take a step. Now you've just taken a conscious step. Okay, so open your eyes back up. Okay, you're going to be walking with your eyes open. The point is to take conscious steps. Recover your life. Now here's the thing. Your mind doesn't want to do that. It's not your best friend. You may sense, of course I want to live my life. I want to be present to every facet of my life, to every activity, to every movement. It makes sense that you'd want to show up for what's going on. It makes sense to 90%, but it doesn't make sense to the top 10% up here. What this is interested in is the goal. That's why it shuts down its attention until you're reaching for the glass of water that you really want. And so when you're walking, it's going to come up with reasons why this is inane. It's boring. This is insidious. Well, who would want to do it? What's the point of this? It will argue against you doing this. This is when I do this, this means pay attention. Because if you don't, you're just, what am I doing this? I'm out of here. Okay, you know that that mind is going to work against your willingness to be aware. It doesn't work. It works on conditioning. It doesn't work on new. It doesn't work on what's new and vital and vitally in front of you. It works on what it's what you've known. It wants everything to be locked up and contained, right? Into little boxes of knowledge, and little boxes, oh, I've done this before, I know exactly. Then you can skip the whole procedure and just go to the end. I know what you're going to say, we say to someone we've lived with for 10 years. I know what you're going to say. I'll show up at the end of your conversation and nod my head. You miss the person completely because, why? Because the mind has already assumed it knows exactly what the conversation is going to be about. But we've missed the conversation. We've missed the connection. We've missed everything in life. Now, it may seem tedious and it may seem boring to you, but if you walk through that boredom, walk through that resistance, you'll find that when you come out of it, there's a sense of aliveness that you will have gained that you would not have gained if you just put this thing on automatic. And that's what I want you to experience in the course of this week, in the course of tonight as well, is the revitalization of your whole circuitry, of your whole organic being. Does everybody understand what I'm saying? Okay, so you want to walk 5 or 10 feet, walk to the end, turn around, walk back. You're not counting laps, right? It doesn't have, he's walking faster than I actually walk. It's your pace, right? So we're going to do this for 20 minutes, and we're going to send you downstairs. Half of you are going to stay up here, and half of you are going to go downstairs, and Ellen is going to lead you downstairs and show you how to section yourself off and walking downstairs, okay? So for everybody on my right side, so from the middle of the aisle, all of you, you'll go down those steps. Just follow Ellen on down the steps. And the rest of you stay up here. I mean, just look at some of the places that you go that you never have left, right? You think you're, they did a study where they randomly chose some people in out of market, and they would just go up and say, okay, where's your mind in this moment? 90% of them weren't even in the market. They're out somewhere thinking about something, you know, that had happened to them at some few distant time or something that was going to happen to them. There's no orientation to where they were in the world. They didn't know where they were. And if we live on this kind of automatic pilot, and we don't even realize we're doing it, but that's an unrecoverable moment of life. If you give yourself off to an abstract thought in time, that moment, as it actually is occurring, can never be recovered. And if you do that enough times, well, you've sort of missed your life. So it makes sense. It makes sense in every direction. Hopefully in these 6 weeks, you'll see eventually that it does make sense. And it'll come in on such a way that you, oh, you know, this is worth doing. It's difficult, there's no question, and it's hard, it's very hard. Because you're going against the stream of your thinking, you're going against the conditioning that has kept us in the dark, in the shadows of our life. So it's valuable. Now, usually when I teach courses, there are twice as many people in the room as there are this evening. I want to mention that if people would like to begin next week, they can. So if you know someone who would like to begin, we keep the expenses so that they're reasonable for everyone. And if you can't afford the price of the 6 weeks, then you can pay what you can. And that's one of the beauties of this organization, is that it's not about profit. It's not about that. It's about other things. It's about giving you something that's truly worthwhile, and doing it as inexpensively and as you can. Now the problem with that is that we usually evaluate the value of something by how much we pay for it. And so if you're not paying much for a 6 week course, and you think in your mind you can devalue it. And I hope you're not doing that, or won't do that in the course of this this time, because it's extraordinarily important. There's a system in this tradition we call Dana, D-A-N-A, which is what the sheet that you will have there. Dana means generosity, and some of us were Buddhist monks in Thailand, I was, and we would go out every morning and receive alms from the villagers, and then they would come to the monasteries and we would teach Buddhism to them. And so there was this beautiful reciprocity. They would sustain us with robes and medicines and food and nourishment and shelter, and we would give them the teaching. And there was no monetary arrangement there. It's just that when I needed a robe, almost before I knew it, maybe it was a threadbare or something, or a new robe would show up on my porch. Or I needed to go to Bangkok and renew my visa, a ticket would be there. Often I didn't even know who donated it. And so this is that beautiful offering of Dana, of mutual appreciation. Well, in this tradition, when we came back from the West, we all have lives to live, expenses, bills to pay, like any of you. But we wanted to keep that sense of mutual reciprocity that the East had taught us. And so we offer the Dana system. The Dana system means the monies you pay for registration go to Seattle Insight to cover their costs, to keep our web page up and running, and all the expenses that an organization incurs just to maintain itself. But there's no salaries. No one's getting a salary in the entire organization. Everybody's a volunteer. And I'm the principal teacher for of this year, and have been in the past, but that's changing. But my life still needs to be I still have bills to pay. So we put what we call a Dana basket out on the table, and it's D-A-N-A for Rodney, and it'll be there each week. And if you'd like to offer something, that's how I pay my bills. I don't pay my bills from the registration fees because I don't get those. So if you'd like to offer something to that, I'm retired. So, you know, that's the other thing about this particular job I've had for so long is that, you know, you don't get sick leave, you don't get vacation, you don't get any of that. And so I really am at the disposal of however you'd like to be able to offer. So please, if you have to remember that. Again, if you know someone who would like to begin the class next week, they're very welcome to do that. But again, I don't think you should miss more than one class if you miss one class. And to encourage whoever it is that you suggest coming to next week that missed this week, that they might want to listen to the first videotape of the series on the web. We will have a class here every Monday, and I know there are holidays that are coming up. I don't know whether this coincides with President's Day or Martin Luther King Day and all of that, but we have them anyway. So regardless of whether there's holidays, there usually are in January and February, we will be here on Monday at 7 for 6 consecutive weeks, 5 after tonight. Now the way it happens is that we start right at 7, so please come early if you can. Come 10, 15 minutes early and just get into the ambiance of being quiet and being just adjusting yourself from the noise of your day so that you can sort of settle in to this space. And then we'll start off with a half an hour meditation from 7 to 7:30 in which I will give you new instructions for that week. So every week you attend, you'll get some extra instructions that I'll want you to practice for that week. And then I keep expanding the instructions. And then we will do what's called a Dharma talk, D-H-A-R-M-A, is a, a word, a Sanskrit word that means the way things are. What's reality look like when we're not projecting our ideas upon it? And so I'll give you a half an hour or 45 minute talk on that, and then we'll do some walking meditation. We'll come back for some question and answers in a large group, and then that'll be the course of the evening. 2 hours goes very quickly. So some of you, I know 7 o'clock is an inconvenient hour, you can't get here on time. Whenever you can get here, come in quietly, sit down, and know that you know, that first half hour is all of us practicing together. Now, here's homework. I told you I would be giving you homework, and I will. So I have three homeworks. One is for you to take a half an hour out of your day, start finding a time, usually when you first get up in the morning or right before you go to bed in the evening, where you can practice meditation. And this week only, you can do a mixture of sitting meditation and walking meditation. So you can do 15 minutes of each, something like that. But take that half an hour, sit for 15 minutes, and then walk for 15 minutes so that you get a feeling for how a half an hour feels like when you're trying to be continuously mindful for that period of time. Try to make it consistently the same time every day. When you do that, it'll become more of a routine for your life, and you will have set that time aside for this particular practice. Okay, so that is your first assignment. Next week, when the new people arrive, I will ask you to sit for 30 minutes. The walking you can do when you're walking to the bus, or when you're walking down the aisles, or when you're walking wherever it is, it's the sitting. We don't have enough time that's just for us when we're quiet and motionless. And so I'm going to be encouraging that forward next week, not this week. But if you'd like to start that this week, you're welcome to do 30 minutes in. I'll have a lot to say about everything that will come up and arise to disrupt your sittings. So don't be surprised if your sittings get disrupted. Right? This is what everybody faces. We'll talk a lot about those problems in the coming classes. Okay, that's the first homework. The second homework is I'd like you to pick an activity that you do every day, right? Combing your hair, brushing your teeth, showering, bathing, whatever it is, putting on your clothes, opening doors, breakfast. Take one activity that you do every day and determine that you are going to be mindful for the duration of that activity. So let's say you're going to brush your hair mindful. Okay, so you pick up the brush, you feel the brush in your hand, you feel what that feels like. You are not in a hurry, so you have to bring patience into this. It's a killer if you try to think what you're going to have to do next after you brush your hair. You won't be brushing your hair, you'll be thinking about what you have to do. So you have to stay very persistent in your attention towards this particular activity. So you brush your hair, you know exactly where in your hair you're brushing, you know the feel of it as you're brushing, all the textures and the physical sensations of it, and you lay down the brush. And now try to get up from brushing your hair and to be mindful as long as you can going forward from that activity, which may not last very long, but that's okay. You did one activity, which I call a marker. Next week, I will give you a second marker, and you will also have to do the first marker. So you have two markers. If you do this every week, you'll have 52 markers at the end of the year. We won't go that far yet, but just start with one, and just hang. It's best if you remind yourself, like hang a little note on your toothbrush or your hairbrush that says, be mindful when doing this activity. Just, you know, have it dangling off there so that you don't pick up your aggression absentmindedly. So you say, oh, or be mindful. Right? Just like that. Or leave a little on your fork as you eat your breakfast. This is by far the hardest homework you ever get, because the mind runs like a locomotive. It has a momentous momentum that just pulls life out of us and thrusts it into the future of where I'm going, what my expectations are. And we spend so much of our life thinking ahead of ourselves and so very little of our life being present to what is actually occurring. And that's why I want you to experience that. I want you to experience how little you actually live where you are. I mean, it's daunting when you see that we never show up for our life. And people want to know where we are. We don't even know. So I want you, unless you see the difficulties and the disposition of our life, you're never going to want to change it. You can take my word, oh yeah, living ahead of myself, that makes sense. Or staying where I am, yeah, of course. But until you experience that you can't bring your mind back, that you can't live where you are, that your mind keeps running off, you go, my God, this is out of control. I'm out of control. I don't know what to do. I'm out of control. You can pray. That's not going to help you very much, though. This is up to you to do this. You've got to do it. And you can. And that's why we meet collectively as a body, as a class, in order to encourage each other forward in this adventure. So that's the second homework. Sit for 30 minutes or walk between 30, for a 30-minute period. Pick a marker that you do every day and hang little notes and make sure that that activity is done so that you're really aware of it. The third one usually gets some kind of sigh of, groan. That is, sleep 8 hours a night. This is wakefulness. This is attention. And we undermine the value of what sleep does to our attention throughout the day. Unless we get sufficient sleep, I can guarantee you this is going to, it's already an upward, it's an uphill journey. It's going to make it that much more difficult. Some of you don't need 8 hours. Get sufficient sleep. And don't use that word sufficient as an excuse to get less sleep than you need. Some of you need more than 8 hours, so get that as well. And it means that you just start taking your life seriously. You can't keep burning this thing at both ends and expect it to be a vibrant life that you are leading. So I really want to encourage you on that third one in particular. Okay, so everybody have their three homework assignments. Now, these homework assignments are accumulative. That is, next week I'll add more to them and expect you to do what you're already doing. I don't want to fail. I don't want to get an F. Nobody fails, okay? Do the best you can. Do the best you can. I'm going to ask a lot from you. All right? So don't just give up and say, oh, I can't do any of it. You can do some of it. You can do most of it. Some of you can do all of it. But you've got to have the intention. You've got to have the intention. Right? So stay with this thing. All right? It's going to get hard. First night's like, oh, a new project, mindfulness. You look it up on the internet, 30,000 hits of what you're doing. Oh yeah, that's true, it's really good. What do you think? You know, I'm being mindful, don't bother. All of that lasts for about a week. And then it begins, the difficulty of it begins to show itself. And it gets hard, gets really hard. You don't want to do it anymore. You want to go back to your own ways, and you say, well, tonight, Monday, God, You know, there's a, I mean, I'm surprised some of you showed up with a national collegiate football game on tonight, so I'm impressed that you did come. But there will be other distractions that, you know, maybe I'll do that. Just do this thing. Suspend your disbelief until you've gone through 6 classes and a day long. And then you can make a judgment about this. You can't make a judgment after 3 weeks. You haven't had enough experience of it to really know whether it's something that you'll connect with or not. So give it the 6 weeks and day long, February 20th. And then see whether it makes sense in your life. And then I'll give you a whole system going forward, like we have post-beginning classes that you can come to if you'd like to do that. So we have a system for to carry you through, but you've got to do these 6 weeks and put forth the effort. I guarantee you that there will be reasons why you won't want to come. Most of them made up. Because it gets harder, you start seeing yourself. You know, when you start seeing yourself, you go, I don't like what I'm seeing. Everybody does that. You look at the mirror and you go, all I see are the blemishes. That's one of the byproducts of early meditation, is that you get scared of yourself. You get scared of what's being revealed. But it's already there. You might as well look and see what's there. It's not going to go away by pretending it's not there. Once you see that it's already there, now you can do something about it. Just remember that. You don't improve by denying. Denial doesn't help. In fact, we're becoming more conscious. That's what this whole thing is about. Self-awareness is about bringing your whole consciousness, greater consciousness, so that you're aware of more things, aware of places that you've denied or been aversive to or avoided in your life. And nobody wants to see those things, but if we're going to raise our consciousness, which this planet needs, now that's not arguable. When you're aware, you don't commit crimes, for one thing, because why would you? When I'm not aware, I can pretend that I can rationalize my way through being a thief. But when I'm aware, the rationalizations don't work. Now you're faced with just the betrayal of being a thief. And so there aren't very many thieves that come to greater awareness. They want to stay in darkness. But we all have that part of our consciousness that is a thief. So we're going to have to face those things. That's week 3. Okay, well, so let me find out any questions from you about walking or about the sitting or about homework or about, yes, sir.
On the walking, can you do it at a normal pace or do you have to?
I will let you decide on what pace you would like to go. Most people start off whatever pace their metabolism is in that moment, however they're racing, often a little faster. And then as they sink into the formality of noticing what they're doing, the whole consciousness sort of quiets down and they start walking walking slower and with a little more precision than they were before. But I wouldn't try to do it so that it starts irritating you. You're walking too slow and there's a feeling of awkwardness and irritation. You know, walk at your speed and then let it slow down on that. Now, about the awkwardness and when you're beginning to notice yourself walking, you're going to find you're out of balance and that it's not quite as easy. And it feels like you're learning to walk and never walked before. You know, it's like, how do I stay up? You know, so people often find an awkwardness when they slow down and you start noticing. That goes away after a while. You don't have to worry too much about that. In the beginning, you're just bringing it under conscious awareness rather than automatic pilot. And to learn, like, what am I supposed to do to walk? Well, I've got to lift, you know, it's a different system. And so there's some awkwardness there as you learn how to do that. Yes, sir.
What I do with my hands, like keeping in front of me, behind me, at my side, does it matter?
Well, you can do whatever is most comfortable for you. We're not following the breath now. When you're walking, you're staying with what the feet, the sensations of the feet. And let the hands, they can be in your pockets or they can be on your back or around, wherever is comfortable for you to naturally let your hands be. But we don't want to make them distractions. So just find a comfortable place and keep them there.
And where do I look? Do I look at my feet?
You're looking down ahead of yourself, about 10 feet. And that's not where you're focused. You're not focused on what you're seeing, although seeing, you want to make sure that you can walk forward without tripping on something. You're focused on what the sensations are in your body. So there's only, give sight 5% of your attention and 95% of your attention on the physical sensation. Yes, sir?
When you experience like a sensation, sometimes a word springs to mind that is that sensation, but I was kind of confused about what you said about being a memory of it as opposed to sort of experiencing.
About differences?
Should you be sort of like, you know, feeling the word and feeling the sensation and the word is associated with it, or just...
Did you hear what he said?
No.
My
hearing isn't the best.
So he's saying he wasn't quite clear about the difference between the word and the sensation and to keep the attention on the sensation or the word.
Okay, so... the words are helpful. They're pointers to the sensation. So when you're sitting, if you want to use words like rising, say your intention is around your breath here, maybe it's at the chest, or maybe it's at the nose tip, in, out, is not more important than the experience of that sensation. So it's just to keep you on the sensation. It's a reminder, it's a tap on the shoulder. In, out, rising, falling, or you can count. If you're going to count, just count up to 5 and then back to 0 and then up to 5, because I don't want you competing against numbers. Right? So in-breath, out-breath 1, in-breath, out-breath 2. That's not the point. The point is where, like you're pointing at the sensation. When you're walking, some people use different words to keep you on the sensations of walking, like lifting, moving, placing, shifting, lifting, moving. That's a way to keep you on what that sensation is actually feeling like as you're saying it, not to try to get the label right about what you're doing, right? So for some people, at some point in their practice, the labels start becoming extra. They don't need them. They're kind of a burden. And so you let that go and you're just with the sensation. But early on, they can be very helpful. Any other questions? Yes?
Walking meditation, it should be inside the shoe-top or it can be outside?
It can be either one. Experiment around. What we're trying to do is to recover our life. So look for times when you can do that, when you wouldn't normally be paying attention. Like you're walking down the streets of Seattle, right? And you're walking at a normal pace. And just suddenly you're just aware of what you're doing and the sounds around you, and you're just walking down the streets, and that's a recoverable moment, right? And so you're going to find the more you practice walking meditation, the more these moments will come up spontaneously throughout your day. Now, that's helpful sometimes inside, sometimes outside, but try different systems so that you don't have systems that you have never tried and seem so foreign to you that you don't bring awareness into them. Like when your shoes are on and you're walking down the middle of the street and there's a lot of noise around. That's also a time to be aware of what's going on, not just in the quiet of your own home with your shoes off. What the value of being quiet in your home with your shoes off is that you can pick up more of the sensation. You can feel more of it, right? So in the beginning, it's helpful to be quiet and to sort of set up a kind of a formal way that you're doing it. But what we want to happen is that our whole lives come under this umbrella of awareness.
Rick, you could say something about the all day?
Well, I don't want to do that on day one, because all day sounds from day one like I can't do that. I'm not going to come to that one. It's an important. It's completely under your power. It's well within your ability to do after 6 weeks. Okay, so as we go through the weeks, I'll give you a little bit of information about it. But right now, I don't want to set you. Oh my God, how am I doing in relationship to that day? I'll never be able to sit for a half an hour and all that. Just follow the course as it's going along. So the homeworks are the key, and I will have little slips starting next week. I'll bring little homework slips for extra credit, ways to start investigating your life to flush out some sort of unconscious moments, ways to uncover or recover those unconscious moments, and so we'll have a lot going on here for the next 5 weeks. Yes, sir, in the back.
Should you wait a certain amount of time before or after the meal, before meditating?
You know, I know that, you know, way back when in the 1960s I was doing TM, 20 minutes only and all that kind of stuff. And I never found that to be true. I could sit much longer. And once I got in this tradition, they encourage you to sit longer. So you can sit for a lot longer than what that limitation was. And also around meal times. And I mean, if you eat right after meal, you'll find that there's a lull of energy and that you'll be sleepy. And so you'll think, well, maybe I'll take a rest for a half an hour before I start up again, something like that. But it'll be biologically based and not some philosophy. So practice and try it different ways and see what the value is and not. Like for some of you who wake up very quickly, going immediately to a place where you can sit for 30 minutes isn't going to be a problem at all. It's a highlight of your energy and you can just do it effortlessly. Others of you who are slow in waking up, you know, may want to put your meditation at the other end of the day, so that right before you go to bed, and it also quiets you down, you know, it soothes you, it releases you from some of the tensions of the day. It's a beautiful way to dovetail yourself into sleep. And you can follow your breath while you're in bed if you want to. One of the markers you can have is to have your alarm go off, and instead of just the snooze button, you hit the snooze button, and then you follow your breath until the alarm goes off again. So between the first time you hit the snooze button and the alarm goes off the second time, that's a beautiful 3 or 4 minutes there where you're getting out of bed from a sense of awareness, which is a very different way of getting out of bed than kind of bundled being with the night still oppressive upon us and the dream world and all of that. You know, you get up, okay, so it's knowing what you're getting out of bed with. What attitude are you getting out of bed with? That sets the disposition of the day. I'm getting out of bed and I'm feeling self-critical. You should know that. As soon as you're aware of it, you break the chain of events that lead to further indulgence. Enough? Okay, so let's just sit for 5 more minutes. See, when I run out of things to say, I just... There's always more to do. So just relax. Take the pressure off yourself. Nobody is grading you. I joke about it, but really, you can't fail. If you're willing to bring your attention back, that's all. You haven't failed. No matter if you've been off for 20 minutes, doesn't matter. You will spend time. Each of you will have meditations in which you will have been on maybe one breath, and the rest, it doesn't matter. It's your intention and your willingness. This is it. I can do this.